Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, the show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Van Weven, and alongside me, as always, is Mr. Chad Carlito Riley.
What's up, Carlito?
Hola.
And also we got Spencer Solito Williams.
Is that even a name?
I don't know. That means little alone one.
That's terrible.
Oh, that really sets the tone for the rest of this review.
Wait, so I'm little Carl?
You're little Carl. And,
and he's little alone one?
He's little alone one.
Aww.
We got a great show in store for you, as we're going to be talking about the recently released Netflix film, Roma. So stick around as we dive into that. But before we do, Chad, let him know.
Alrighty, very few things are as black and white as they appear, but one thing is pretty clear. The Filmlosophers is still brought to you by Mingle Media TV and VGB Studios. They pay us to say that, by the way.
That's right.
No, they actually don't.
That's right.
We're just about as consistent as the sunrise and a good day's work. New episodes of The Filmlosophers drop for subscribers each Wednesday morning on all of the world's most popular streaming platforms, including Spotify, iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Libsyn, Player FM, and Audio Boom. Spencer, where else can people engage with us?
Here's some good news. You don't have to join our youth revolt for your voice to be heard.
That is good news.
Yeah. Just follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/filmlosophers and on Twitter at twitter.com/filmlosophy101. Whenever you're in the mood to escape the pleasures of day-to-day life for an hour or so, we have a lot of options for you to explore in our archives. Visit filmlosophers.com for a rundown of every episode we've ever published, along with extra features we've shared over the years.
That's right. We got 144 lovely, scrumptious episodes for you to devour, and yeah. So that's really
lovely and scrumptious.
They are lovely and scrumptious, as is this pie that I'm eating.
That's exactly why you said scrumptious.
I am eating a lemon tart. Leave me alone. But that does not derail us from our current conversation, which is talking about Alfonso Cuarón's Roma. This film has been getting a lot of attention within the award circles. It just recently won a few awards, and we'll talk about those in a second. But after hearing about it for so much time, we decided to actually check it out and see what this film was about. And honestly, I will be the first one to say I didn't really hear a lot of publicity about it. I didn't really hear that it was going to be debuted on Netflix. I had just heard that a film had dropped on Netflix by Alfonso Cuarón. So,
wait, you didn't see the teaser?
No.
That's so interesting, because I remember the teaser dropping a couple of months ago, and it's part of the scene that opens the film with the washing of the driveway and the plane flying over reflected in the water.
Where'd you see it at?
The internet? I don't know.
I
on my iPad, on the internet.
On the interwebs.
Digital space.
Speaking of digital space, Chad, why don't you give us that official synopsis goodness?
I'd love to. In Alfonso Cuarón's autobiographically inspired film, set in Mexico City in the early 70s, we are placed within the physical and emotional terrain of a middle-class family whose center is quietly and unassumingly held by its beloved live-in nanny and housekeeper, Cleo. Roma tells us an epic story of everyday life. That's an interesting phrase. While also gently sweeping us into a vast cinematic experience in which time and space breathe and majestically unfold.
Uh-huh.
What was the uh-huh for?
Just, I would not have phrased, you know, time and space breathe and majestically unfold. More of like, you know, time and space are shown to you in real time sometimes. Like, it's a bit rough.
Directed by Alfonso Cuarón, the film stars Yalitza Aparicio, Marina de Tavira, Diego Cortina Abri, and many others.
That's the most Spanish inflected I've ever heard you speak. That's amazing. You can do it.
I can do it sometimes. It comes and goes in waves. As we mentioned, the film did win a few awards, including it winning the Golden Globe Best Director Award, Best Motion Picture in Foreign Language, and the Best Screenplay Award. Currently, it holds 8 nominees for the BAFTA Awards, including the David Lean Award for Direction for, obviously, Alfonso Cuarón. Called the most essential movie of his career, Cuarón not only directed the film, but also wrote it and was its cinematographer as well, which is pretty interesting because usually as a director, you're more focused on directing, you know, giving direction and so forth. And to see that he kind of held both of those roles, it just means that there was much more at stake for him.
I believe he was also the primary editor. If my Spanish reading of the opening credits is on point, he filled most of the non-performer primary roles. Like,
really?
Aside from like composer and stuff like that. But yeah, he did the heavy lifting.
Huh. Well, who would have thunk it? According to the director, 90% of the scenes represented in the film are scenes taken out of his memory. As we mentioned previously, this is a autobiographically inspired film, and so this is actually based on his life and the live-in nanny that he had, which her name was Libo. And the film was actually shot in location in Mexico City. There was talk as to whether or not this film was either shot on location or if there was a, you know, back lot that was redone. No, he actually did pretty much all of the filming for this film in Mexico City, which is pretty unique.
Well, Mexico City is enormous.
Yeah.
So there were probably like back lots in Mexico City also, because it wasn't there. We saw a series of tweets from your favorite director.
Yes, sir.
Guillermo del Toro. Right. in which he praised Alfonso Cuarón for, yes, the amount, like the volume, the size of the sets that were built on backlots, which is an under-talked-about
yeah,
aspect of the behind-the-scenes production of the film.
True. And speaking of which, Guillermo del Toro, who actually presented the film at the New York Film Festival and who was also the president of the jury at the 75th Venice Film Festival, which awarded the film the Golden Lion Award, he actually named Roma one of his top 5 favorite films of all time.
So, which, you know, is super significant.
Looking
at the style of film that he creates.
Yes.
And it would be reasonable to assume that he enjoys that, you know, visual, sumptuous, like very intricate, multi-layered visuals kind of approach.
Yeah.
It's interesting given his kind of cinematic eye, how we've seen, and then naming this one of his top 5 films of all time, because it's very different, like very, very different stylistically.
From what he's done.
From what he has in his filmography, yeah.
Yes and no. I think the idea of him creating... Because one of the things that always sticks out for me for Mr. Del Toro was the fact that...
That's Señor Del Toro.
Señor Del Toro. It's a lot of... is that he likes to create stories that tell the journey of an individual, whether through fantastical means or however, like you take a look at, you know, Hellboy or... The Devil's Backbone, even Kronos, or even one of the more popular ones, Pan's Labyrinth, the one that everybody mostly mm-hmm. knows when they talk about him. They all usually entail the journey of an individual going through life as it is for them in their current universe, so to speak. And I think this is something similar in that aspect. I think the thing that resonated with him was the ability that Cuarón kind of takes in terms of creating that parallel to what he's done. Just from my own personal opinion with Guillermo. But
we're on a first name basis now.
Oh, yeah. Me and him had lunch the other day. Brother. It was great. But, I mean, this film actually... So, like we said, it debuted on Netflix. It was one of those types of films that, for me, and I'm I don't know if I could probably speak for everybody else, but I think for me, it didn't really get a lot of publicity. I didn't really hear a lot about it. I didn't really know about it until I'm looking through my Netflix queue and this film, Roma, is up there. And I'm like, oh, okay, well, let's check it out. And I feel kind of bad because Alfonso Cuarón is actually an incredible director. He's done some magnificent films, like with Gravity. He did The Revenant. He did
Children of Men.
Children of Men.
Y Tu Mamá También.
Y Tu Mamá También. Which happened to be actually, if you're keeping score, Y Tu Mamá También was actually the first and only other time that he's actually filmed an entire film in Mexico, which that was back in 2001. This now being the second time with Roma. But to recognize a prolific director such as him, who has created great pieces of work throughout our cinematic history, and then to kind of out of the blue say, oh, by the way, I dropped something on Netflix, you guys should take a look. Like, for me, that just kind of seemed out of the blue. I wasn't expecting it. What about you, Spence? Were you expecting this film to be on Netflix at all?
No. Like, I had never heard of it until, like, you guys mentioned it a week ago. And then I forgot the name of the movie. And then you guys had to text me what it was again. Like, that is all of the foreknowledge I went
Spencer
into.
Spencer is
only
every
did
man.
It, did, it not, did he not know about it? It also wasn't recommended to him by Netflix.
No.
So... What are you watching on Netflix, Spencer?
A lot of anime.
Movies like this. Because, like, it showed up and it was like, well, you want to watch this?
Netflix is like, are you sure? Is this Spencer?
It didn't even have, like, a rating of, oh, we think you, it's like, here it is. Do what you will.
Well, and I think that's one of the unique things. Kind of jumping into kind of our conversation, one of the things I wanted to mention, like, was the difference in terms of, like, experiencing a film on Netflix and experiencing a new film. Not like a film like, oh, I saw that a few years when it debuted. It's on Netflix. Let's watch it. I mean, like, a fresh new film that drops on Netflix, which we heard at the beginning of 2018, or actually it might have been before 2018, that Netflix was planning to release all these brand new movies. Like, they were going to be just bombarding their streaming service.
Yeah, there was something like $7 billion globally being spent on content creation for various markets.
Exactly. And this was one of those ones, I'm assuming, that was a part of that. And the fact is that when a new film drops on Netflix, I'm going to be honest, I'm not too in a hurry to check it out. Like, we were just talking prior to going on air, we were talking about the recent hype with Bird Box and Bandersnatch, which sounds like the guy who plays Doctor Strange. But either way, we're not those films have been hyped up so much that it's like, well, I don't know. Like, I'm not really running to my, you know, Netflix queue to go and throw it in there and watch it, just because previous experiences have shown for me Netflix originals, they're good, but they're not like raving great, you know.
I would agree with you in general. There have been a few that I've really enjoyed, especially on the serialized TV format.
Yeah.
There have been quite a few that I've enjoyed. The feature length film options and offerings are a little more lackluster in general for me. I mean, we've reviewed a few in the history of the Filmlosophers.
That we have.
Not very many, but a few. And yeah, usually for me, the feature length options don't really hit the mark.
Yeah, it's true, because actually, now that you mention it, there was an episode or a lesson that we did not too long ago, back in October, on two end of the world type films that were released from Netflix. And in all honesty, I don't think we gave it pretty high marks. I don't remember enjoying it that much. But
the concept was better than the execution, I think.
It's true. And I think the fact is that film just really, those films kind of just really missed the mark for me. I didn't really enjoy it. I didn't really have fun with it.
But then again, like, wasn't the Cloverfield universe prequel-ish thing that was Netflix released also, and that was enjoyable.
Was lesson 101.
Hey, Spencer.
Oh, look at you.
Point.
And actually the films that we talked about earlier in terms of the other Netflix films was lesson 131 where we reviewed Michael Peña's movie, as well as the other. Needless to say, we've had our experiences here on the episode with Netflix originals, and it's kind of hit or miss. And so I say all that to say, I'm not too keen on running to Netflix to see any original because of the fact that I want to see, first off, what everybody else is going to say. And I want to know, like, what's, you know, test the waters first. I want to see what other people are doing when they're testing the waters.
Well, and I think that this is a special case because this is one of your, like, marquee directors in global cinema, right? And that is much more unique. It's a much more rare bird, if you will, for Netflix to be the distribution arm for one of these, like, very highly regarded, highly respected, generation-defining directors to release a new and highly personal film through Netflix. That's a very unique case, I think. Most of the other Netflix films have also been, to some degree, Netflix-produced. And I don't know that Netflix produced this one, aside from probably giving money to it, but he wrote it, directed it, edited it, was a cinematographer. Who knows, maybe he is dressed up and playing a role in the background somewhere. I mean, he really seemed to do everything.
He's Cleo the entire time, just saying. Just no, but
now that would be trippy and very awkward.
But it's been an interesting last few months for movies, because in this instance, like, okay, so we had a very unique and prolific director who has his name attached. I didn't know he did all these things until we started doing research for this film. But he had his name attached to this, and it went to Netflix. We had a similar...
See, now, I remember, though, they started talking about this about a year and a half ago, I think. Because it was big news when they announced that he was going to do it through Netflix a long time ago. And I remember reading kind of like, almost like production diary kind of updates along the way. So For some people, this was not a surprise, other than someone of his quote-unquote stature in the industry would go the Netflix route versus releasing into theaters.
Whereas within previous experiences on this show, we've had an unfortunate viewing, which turned fortunate because it was a fun episode, but of seeing The Immortals, which was released in theaters and had the attached name of Peter Jackson. Not knowing full well...
Oh, Mortal Engines?
Mortal, what did I say?
I was like, Immortals was...
no, not Henry Cavill.
Not reviewed by us, but we've seen it.
Immortal...
Yeah, the Mortal Engines. Yeah.
Yes, I've already been pushing that out of my head. I picked another movie to think about. Mortal Engines, where we knew Peter Jackson was attached, and it was released in theaters, and it was going to be like this huge IMAX experience. And we went and we engaged and we experienced all of it and still came out unimpressed. And so on the flip side of that, we have somebody who is attached to this film. It debuts on Netflix, and even though, going back to Mortal Engines got like high marks from the actual author. The author visited the set, looked at everything, was like, oh my gosh, it's so great, it's even better than I imagined, blah blah blah. Now I'm wondering what the author was paid for that. But either way, for this case, you have Alfonso Cuarón attached to this piece, and it didn't stink. Like, it wasn't bad, in my opinion, you know? So
yeah, there is definitely a lot to respect and appreciate about it. I don't know that I personally would give it a glowing review, but part of that is just, like, how I'm used to viewing movies nowadays. This very much aesthetically, pacing-wise, and even the nature of the story... it's aiming for something different than your typical, like, in theater movie would do. And maybe that's part of the reason why he decided to go with Netflix as his distribution partner for this particular film. Because it does, it moves, it has different aims, and it moves at a different pace than most contemporary movies that you would be used to seeing, you know, now.
Spence, what were some of your expectations going into this movie? Like, obviously, you got to see it at home. You didn't have to go and pay to go see this. This was a film that you could easily access access via your computer, via your Netflix account. What were some of the expectations going into it?
I had none. I knew nothing about it, and I was like, okay, I'm watching this. And that was about it. I think I'll talk about my first couple of minutes watching it, though, because that was a bit of a struggle.
Well, first mention why it was a bit of a struggle. You have to include the text message that we sent you. And
okay, like
we tried to help you.
We did. We sent you a life raft there. We sent you a lifeline, and you just
word to the wise.
Yeah. Okay. So I was busy, so I wasn't fully comprehending what I was reading. But
kids, this is why you should pay attention to the things that you read.
But I could have sworn Chad's like, "Oh yeah, you should watch this movie when you're sleepy." So I'm like, okay. So, like, I'm, like, getting ready for bed, I start up the movie, and it's just, like, this water on a driveway. And I'm like, okay, we're doing fine. We get about 60 minutes in.
We're doing fine.
And then I'm having, like, this debate in my head. Like, I can't be one of those people who goes for, like, an electronic device because nothing happened in 60 minutes, right? Because that'd be stupid. So another 60 seconds passes, and I'm on my Switch by this point. I'm so
I'm like, so
this
glad
is
we
real
this.
Life.
So I'm 2 minutes into this movie, and I'm just like watching this water on a driveway, and I'm like, so is someone washing this driveway? Because I didn't know what was happening. Like, I saw the airplane in the reflection, and like at this point I started like doing that hover with your mouse so you can see like the little images of what's coming up next, and like it's washing the driveway for 5 minutes, a literal 5 minutes with like some credits before like, and I didn't skip over it, but I was playing my Switch. And
Spencer is the everyman who is listening to this podcast.
I really am for this movie because it's hard. Like, I'm kind of glad it wasn't in a theater because I don't think I could have done it as well.
And I think that's very true. I mean, I watched it with my fiance, and we were both really struggling during the opening credits because there's not even a lot of ambient noise. But at the same time, it definitely sets what I believe to be accurate expectations for the entire duration of the film. There are a few punctuation mark moments that happen mostly in the final third of the movie.
Yeah.
Act three, if you will.
Yeah.
But most of the film is very
melancholy.
No, like it's more about making an observation. Like it's kind of the way I described it after seeing it was it's like instead of a series of jump cuts, which you'd get in a lot of movies these days,
right?
Not just action movies, but just like we have short attention spans that are getting shorter by the minute.
Mm-hmm. True.
Ironically. And so any kind of movie, like you can do a period piece with people in like, you know, corsets and ridiculous wigs and horse-drawn carriages, whatever. And you would have jump cuts just to keep the story moving along because that's the style of storytelling we're used to. This movie is much more like a series of, let's say, 40 panoramic images on your iPhone, and you're watching the camera slowly pan from left to right or from right to left as some things are happening in the frame. And yeah, some of them are static. They're not actually, the camera's not moving at all. It's just still. But I mean, it's much more like, let me invite you into this world.
Yeah.
And have you really take your time noticing all the details of this world. Now, that becomes very complicated because the entire film is beautifully shot in black and white.
Yes.
So the pops of color that might, you know, help to liven up the visuals of a scene are not there. It's not poorly shot at all. It's beautiful cinematography, especially for a black and white piece. But to be kind of required to linger on mostly visual information where most of the information you're used to seeing has been left out of the frame, as in like color specifically, it's a lot to ask, I think, of a contemporary audience. It's not impossible, but it definitely... I and my fiance both found it challenging to stay alert and stay in the moment with the characters, because also the way that things transpire, unlike a lot of stories that you're used to seeing in a visual format, if I were to, you know, sort of list all the beats of the story, I would not end up with what I felt like was a 2.5 hour movie of events. It would be about 55 minutes of events that you're asked to almost meditate on.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't...
Over the span of 2.5 hours or whatever it is. It feels like 5.
Well, yes and no. One of the things that I've kind of just realized about myself is I kind of stick around for the long game when it comes to films like this. Like, I will sit through the if the film for me is engaging, I will sit through, you know, mellow dialogue, and I will follow along with the character, and I will engage within what's happening. Like, for instance, like when we went to go see Blade Runner 2049,
oh, here we go. Yes, I fell asleep.
I was watching.
Yes, I fell
the
asleep
entire film,
more than once.
And I was engaged with the film. But like in any film like that, like I'm a huge fan of like classic cinema, 60s, 50s, where a lot of the intros to those were just build-ups and build-ups to something bigger that doesn't happen till like the tail end. And I like to sit around for the story. I just like to engage in that way. Not that my preference or my ability to see a film is any different than or any better than anybody else. It's just my preferred preference. I found this film as like this, yes, it was a slow burn, but every single like beat that I found in the film was something that, and it was probably the connecting points, but something that I could see as like a part of my family or part of the dynamic of what I saw as family within my parentage and whatnot. And I think that was, for me, the connecting point that kept me like dialed in from the first second, watching 6 minutes of a you know, driveway getting clean from poop, you know, from dog poop. Because of the fact that I used to do that when I was a kid. So that was...
Well, know. Yeah, but in those 5 minutes, you don't even see the poop.
No.
Yeah. You see the stone, you start hearing water, and then eventually the water enters the frame.
Mm-hmm.
And then you see the plane go over, and then you see more water and suds mm-hmm. in the frame. So it's a lot to... It's like a tease. that opening sequence in particular... is like a tease. And I think the best visual, which was in the trailer a few months ago,
mm-hmm.
is when the water comes in and you see kind of the shape of buildings above you, really, from where the camera's looking down at the ground, and the airplane goes over, and you get the sense of, oh, you're not going to ascend. You're not going to leave this place.
Mm-mm.
Like, it's very, like, there's a lot of foreshadowing.
Oh, 100%.
In that scene, but you have to be more patient than most movies nowadays require you to be.
Yeah.
To really pay attention to what it's telling you.
Mm-hmm.
Contextually, with no dialogue, very little visual, and an extended, you know, credit sequence, whatever. Like, it you have to really settle into it, I think.
True. Let's go ahead and jump right into the film. You know what? We haven't even gone through everybody else's expectations. Chad, your expectations, any, if at all?
Yeah, well, I saw the trailer.
Yeah.
Which was about minute 45
mm-hmm.
section of that opening 5 minute sequence. It's, you know, not quite the earliest part, kind of all the way up until the plane flies overhead. So that, I knew that was going to happen. I even told my fiance, I'm like, just wait, a plane's about to fly over in the reflection, because I had
yeah.
seen it, you know, 2 or 3 months before in the trailer. I remember when the trailer hit, I thought, oh, this is very quiet. Like, it doesn't tell you anything about the story. It is a minute and 45 seconds of water moving on concrete.
Yeah.
And a plane reflected in the sky above you. So I didn't know, like, who the main characters were or necessarily the setting, although I had read quite a bit, again, as it was being created. So I knew it was very autobiographical, pulled from his memory, set in Mexico City in the 70s. Like, I knew all of that from interviews they did with him as he was creating the film. But I really didn't know what to expect. It's been a while since I've seen a black and white film. The last one I can recall was the one, I don't remember what it was named, but the one that won the Oscar.
The Artist?
The Artist, yeah, with the cute dog.
Yes.
That was the last one I saw, and they're very different. The Artist versus Roma, very different.
Yeah.
Tonally and how they tell their story. So then we're getting into the film, and I don't know, like, I can't say that I went in expecting a lot, but I can't say that I went in expecting a little either, because I've appreciated most of Cuarón's other films, mm-hmm. especially Gravity, as like nauseatingly dizzying as it was for a lot of people, especially those of us who saw it in 3D.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed the way the story was told. It was almost like hyper visual. There was my last recollection of an experience with one of his movies. And then here, it's hyper visual, but in a very different way.
Yeah.
Because there's no color, because it's very slow, where Gravity was dizzying in most of its sequences. This one was never dizzying. It wasn't even the pace that I would turn my own head.
Yeah.
It was like, if my head turned at a quarter speed or lower, this might be how long I take to look around the room. You know, like, and
it's a very accurate representation.
I wasn't expecting that. So it was a lot to adjust to. And I didn't really know that I don't know that I had expectations going in, other than I wanted to see what new artistic statement he was making this time, especially because he's pulling from his own memories.
Yeah.
Of that time.
Yeah.
I don't know that he knew any of the characters per se, but his memories of the time were what influenced the entire look and feel of the film.
Yeah. Like, for me, I kind of have to side with Spence in terms of like expectations. I really didn't have much of a clue in terms of what the film had for me, or whether or not it was going to be worth watching. Previous experiences, like we just mentioned, were kind of keeping me from being too excited. But at the same time, it's Alfonso Cuarón. You know, you recognize a lot of his previous works. You've recognized like the way he takes storytelling into his own hands. And so I was hesitant in watching it because of the fact that, like we've said with other Netflix originals, there's a lot of hype. There's a lot of people talking, and because it's easily accessible, people can go on and on and on and talk about it over and over because they've seen it about a million times on their own queue. So I was adamant, to say the least. But, you know, jumping right in, I think one of the things that's unique about the film is the fact that I think this is the complete opposite, if you will, of Gravity. This film is, like Chad said, it is slow. It does take its time. It does slowly burn through the story. But for me, I really actually enjoyed a lot of the steps that I saw the film took. I loved seeing the progression of recognizing the main character, who's named Cleo, who is played by, see if I can pronounce her name again correctly, Yalitza Aparicio. The character actually going through some beats of like, yes, she's a house nanny and yes, she lives there, but she also has a life. And due to that, she ends up becoming pregnant and things start happening that I became engaged with. I began to recognize like, oh my gosh, this woman's pregnant. What happens next? So for me, it seemed like the, reading through this really interesting book, just really slowly for me. But I found myself just staying engaged because, like I mentioned, I found a connecting point for me. I'm Hispanic, and mind you, I am probably the most non-Hispanic you'll ever see.
True.
But the fact remains is that the rest of my family, God bless their soul, they are true to form Hispanics. And so, like, I see a lot of the things in this particular character, or even in the circumstances that this character is in, I find myself, like, seeing, oh my gosh, yeah, I've seen that happen with so-and-so, or yeah, I've seen this happen with so-and-so, or I've seen this. And I think that was part of the thing that kept me engaged throughout the whole film. So for me, a lot of the connecting points kept me drawn in. But like I said, you have the main character named Cleo who lives in this house with this woman and her husband at the time with all their kids and the grandmother. And her and another live-in nanny.
And the dog.
And the dog.
That poops everywhere all the time.
Named Barros or whatever. Mm-hmm. I don't remember. I just remember reading it in the subtitles. But then at some point, the dad decides he doesn't want to be there anymore. And he leaves, leaving the house in this some type of like limbo. And she is trying to do her job. She finds out she's pregnant. They're trying to make it work. All the while, this revolt is happening in the background of Mexico City during the early 1970s. I don't know, for all that, for all of those things, it made me like engaged,
but it took an hour and 40 minutes to get to the point really that you just said that in about 2 minutes.
Yes.
But it takes a very long time to unfold those story elements, which there's nothing by definition wrong with that. It's, mm-hmm. it's just different than what you typically see nowadays
yeah.
in the pacing of a feature length film.
You know, something that confused me was, like, with as slow as the movie was, like, you know, building up things, like, there was, like, a rather, I don't know, like, time became very hard to tell. Like, at one point you can, like, it said, oh, you're, like, 3 to 4 months pregnant, and then the baby's just suddenly here, and I'm like, wait, how come we're going so fast all of a sudden? Like, I don't understand the speed.
She had Christmas, and then New Year's.
I remember New Year's. I don't remember Christmas, though.
Christmas tree?
Yeah, it was. I mean, it was all one, like, big family retreat with the weird, like, chupacabra.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was, I thought at first, because they all seemed to be wearing lederhosen, I was thinking of Krinkelmas from The Office. I was like, oh, is that Krinkelmas that Dwight, like, reincarnated on The Office?
Okay, I thought
but it was... No, it was like a chupacabra type... figure, right?
I thought it was a ghillie suit. Like, in all honesty, a ghillie suit is those things that hunters wear, so that way they, or not just hunters, but anybody who's, you know,
blending into
their environment
landscape. Like, but it had a head. Like, it had it was a character.
Yeah.
Somebody was playing, and then in what I thought was arguably the earliest, like, action scene of the film, which was New Year's, where there's a conflagration, a fire.
Yeah.
Like, that, suddenly there's this kind of burst of activity, but it's sort of a slow burst still. And then whoever's inside that suit steps right up to the camera and sings a whole song, and then, like, forlornly walks back away into the... And so it's just like... It's constantly working to subvert your expectations, I think, because it wants you, it's kind of, you know, like if it's pulled from memory, it makes sense that it wants you to kind of think in a memory kind of way, where sometimes the scenes do jump unexpectedly 4 months into the future, and now you're supposed to know that she's about to give birth to the baby that, after waiting a really long time for her to even become pregnant, suddenly she's through the pregnancy and ready to deliver, and then beyond. There's sort of a timelessness to it, but not in the sense of like this is a timeless tale of whatever, but like literally you're kind of existing outside of time, aside from when the year changes. It's very specific. You're going from 1970 to 1971,
right?
And I can only assume that people who were alive at that time, and most likely in that area, already knew what to expect with regard to like the youth revolt thing going on and all of that, which obviously we're all younger than that.
Yeah.
So it was new to me when that stuff started happening later on in the film.
Yeah, I barely know 1970s American history, so I definitely don't know.
That is true.
Like Mexico history. But like talking about that fire for a brief second, like because that scene was confusing to me. So was someone trying to murder them with fire? Because, like, that was not... That seemed very deliberate.
I think it was supposed to be a firework misfired and started the fire in the forest.
Oh, right, it's New Year's. Okay.
Yeah. But I'm like, Spence, that happens in our own backyard. What are you talking about?
Well, it's just hard to remember what's going on.
No, it's true, because like, there's some mention of like, oh, so-and-so's son died in the revolt about this, or this happened because they're taking the land over here. And then all of a sudden you see like this massive property, and on the other side of this forest line, you see this growing blaze that comes up from behind it, which, here's the thing, kind of talking about the cinematography of this film, the way this film was shot, and Chad had mentioned it earlier, I actually really adored the way this film was shot. Like, I think that was also a part of what kept me fully engaged, was seeing how Cuarón doesn't just shoot the film, but he makes you like an observer of what is happening. He puts you right in the center of what is happening. So as the film scales left to right rather than in any other direction, like it doesn't go diagonally left here, then diagonally left there, and then up and down and right and left. It takes a shot and it'll pan either left or right. It doesn't really, you know, divert in any direction, but it makes you feel like every time you're seeing something and it starts to pan, it's giving you a full glimpse of like the surroundings. There's a shot actually early on in the film when Cleo is turning off all the lights in the house at night.
Except for the one that she turns on.
Except for the ones that she turns on the lamp by the window. But it starts right with her at the stairwell, and it follows her all the way around the room, and the camera's watching her, and it's like, I felt like I was sitting in the center of the foyer watching her do this as she's, you know, preparing her routine of going to bed after that. And I thought that was really cool. I thought that was super cool, to be honest with you. In my, you know, great in, you know, filmlosopher terms, I thought it was super cool the way he made me feel that way in that moment. And I'm sitting on my bed watching it on my laptop. I'm like, huh, I should go do something or turn off a light or something. So, but it's instances like that that kept me like fully.
I should go turn off a light.
I should go flip a switch somewhere. But I don't know, Spence, what did you think about like the way the film was filmed and the way that, you know, the director saw how to shoot the film?
Well,
oi.
You know, he had a stylistic vision of what he wanted to do. It does look good. Like, it really does. I think it's pretty great looking. It's just, like, mostly the things I got out of this movie from, like, his choices on what he was doing visually was more of, like, what I notice in movies on a whole. Because I had other problems that kind of pointed out like how much I rely on things that weren't there this time.
Ah,
like color.
It's like graduating from picture books to novels.
Okay, I'm just kidding, sure, just whatever.
Kidding. I'm just kidding.
Like, I had a hard time like telling people apart because apparently I only use color.
Really?
To like
telling people apart.
Yeah.
So we all look alike. Is that what it
is? No, it's not that.
Oh, brother.
Like,
Spencer, keep going.
When, like, people have very distinct hairstyles. Yes, obviously.
What do you mean,
that.
You people?
I said when people, not you I'm people. Just You're a jerk. You know I wouldn't do that. But, like, no. It was hard to, like, just orientate myself to, like, this is who you are and this is who this is. Plus, like, whenever someone said a name, I tried to, like, catch it so I know how to pronounce it, but then I'd miss reading it, and then it was, like, this whole thing where I was off. So, you know, it was a real adventure with this movie.
Chad, you were going to say something?
No, I don't know exactly how to put my thoughts into words. I think that there is a lot to love technically about this movie. And the main character, Cleo, it's very easy to sympathize with her.
Right.
However, in my opinion, I'm going to step in it.
Oh boy.
In my opinion, they don't really allow her to do very much. Like, there's a lot of cleaning and tidying up and being yelled at and then playing with the kids and whatever, but she is the heart of the story. And I think at the beginning, you kind of know that because she's the first character that you know a name for. But then you've got all these family members because she works for a family. So yeah, there's a husband, a wife, a grandmother, and four children.
So many kids.
Plus the dog. You know, and then there's Cleo and the other servant woman.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't sure, like, are they sisters? Yeah. Are they cousins? Are they related? Like, you're kind of, in a way, you're expected to know, but then at the same time, you're expected to not have to care. But I think, again, in movies nowadays, it's very commonplace to, like, define certain things up front so that you can just pay attention to the story. And I think this film is trying to give us more of, like, an emotional experience, kind of almost like getting to know the character of Cleo without being told very much. Because, I mean, even when important things are happening around her, she's pretty quiet.
Yeah.
You know, she's not really assertive. And I don't say that as a slam against her.
No, no, no.
But she's not an overly active participant in her own life. And I think you're meant to sit with that feeling, but at the same time, when that's your main character, it's very difficult because unlike, you know, Gravity, where you've got Sandra Bullock's character, like, is like she has to act or she will die in space.
Yeah.
So, like, she has to keep doing and doing and doing and doing and doing and doing, and the will to live and the drive to, you know, get back home. And she has her own, like, rebirth experience at the end of that movie, barely making it out, you know, after splashdown or whatever. Like, it's beautiful. Yeah. There's a lot of, like, non-dialogue messaging that happens, especially in the third act of that film. And here, similarly, it takes so long to work yourself to a point, but at the same time, you're following a character who, by virtue of her her role in life in terms of her profession, her status or standing with regard to the other characters. The characters in the family are obviously of a different social economic class than she is.
Yeah.
And just circumstance, everything is done to her or toward her rather than her being the one with the agency to do something.
Yeah.
And that comes to a head by the climax of the film when she's, you know, going into the water after two of the kids in the family, and you finally see, like, a dramatic action from her.
Mm-hmm.
And then immediately thereafter, there's this, like, cathartic opportunity, you know, where she's confessing things to the family and whatever. And releasing the weight of all the things you've watched happen to her.
Yeah.
Or around her, but mostly to her. And I think that being the character who's the focal character and that character doesn't have a lot of agency, it's challenging as a viewer. That doesn't make it bad.
No.
But it's challenging because you're used to your main characters driving the dramatic, like, there's a reason why you are the main character. And it's not typically because other people do things to you.
Yeah. I can see your perspective on that. And I can see that viewpoint. Spencer, you had mentioned that there were other things that bothered you about this movie.
Yeah, most of the movie.
He's like, what bothered you? The movie.
Because it's just a very sad story about what happens to, like, this little maid type person. And it's just one thing after another. And especially that scene on the beach at the end, I was like, that was the part where I was like, okay, I'm done with this movie. Because her confessing that she didn't want the baby anyway, like, it kind of just was like, I feel like I've had enough of this. Because, like, this movie is very good at making you sit with a feeling, But the problem with that is you will sit with that feeling whether you want to or not. And more often than not, I did not. I wanted to leave, like, quite often. And
go back to the Nintendo Switch.
Or just get out of that scene or something, because it was rough. Like, from the incident with her jerk of a boyfriend to, like, the whole I'm having a baby thing, especially that was just doing way too much.
I don't know, like, so so here's the thing. You know what? Actually, Chad.
Yes,
what were some of your issues with the film as well? And I'll give my perspective after.
I think that I've really talked about everything that I had kind of prepared to say in terms of, like, the slow pacing, the lack of clarity in the beginning on whose story you were supposed to be following, and really throughout. I mean, you're kind of supposed to follow all of them, but then it's almost like the movie expects you to already know them, or the fact that somebody like me, who I took Spanish for 4 years in high school, but I'm not fluent, so I'm going to still rely on the subtitles. So maybe it was relying on the subtitles to tell me, like, people's names. I'm sitting here right now on IMDb, and I read a storyline synopsis, and I'm like, I didn't know half of the characters' names by the end of the movie. And I was paying attention. Like, oh, yeah, they did, I guess, say his name once or twice. But there are a lot of names to keep track of. And and it was also, like, even if I was fluent in Spanish, there would still be parts of the movie that I wouldn't have gotten without subtitles, because Cleo and the other servant woman speak a different language. They code switch between Spanish and a different language.
Yeah.
So, and that happens, and it shows you in brackets, you know, when that's happening. But, you know, so anyway, small side note, I think I've covered all my quibbles. I will say there were some things that I did genuinely enjoy.
Oh, okay.
And things that I picked up on that I thought were valuable.
Is that funny to you, Spence? The fact that
I was reading the keywords for IMDb for this movie, and there are nanny, mopping a floor, 1970s, maid, and childbirth.
Well, there you go. That covers all the basics, if you will.
Also, in reading this storyline synopsis, I found that I dove way too deep into the title.
How so?
Well, the whole time I'm waiting for them to explain what Roma is.
Yeah.
Right? And they never do. Now, this write-up says that it's set predominantly in the Colonia Roma neighborhood of Mexico City.
Yeah.
That's never really explained.
No.
Along with many other things, you're expected to know it or not. I, in watching it about two-thirds of the way through, and my fiance was asking, why do you think it's named Roma? And I'm like, I don't know. We're kind of passing the time during these longer sequences that aren't very dialogue-heavy or active. And I'm saying, you know, actually, if you think about it, Roma is Amor backwards. But then Amor is French. So... yeah, I'm like, I dove way too deep. I dove way too deep and came up with nothing. But I didn't realize, like, you don't know what you don't know.
Yeah.
But I did want to say, before we super dive into the gripes that Spencer and I have shared, and you give us our counterpoint, which is great, I did enjoy one thing in particular.
What's that?
That was the very odd moment with, I think his name is Professor Zovek.
Yeah.
Professor
Zovek. Best character.
In, like, what, two-thirds of the way through the movie?
Yes.
And the exercise that he does, and the only one to successfully do it first try with him, is Cleo.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, you go, girl. Like, that's cool. Like, I don't necessarily know that this scene was 100% essential, or his part of the scene, I guess.
Yeah.
But it did give you insight into how balanced her mental and physical being must be, because he was saying basically, like, you have to be very balanced and aligned mentally and physically to do this exercise, and she does it right off the bat. So I'm like, oh, that actually gives me an insight into her that I wouldn't otherwise have had. I would not draw that conclusion without that moment.
Yeah. So to give the counterpoint that I have, I hear everything you guys are saying. And in all earnest, I do see that perspective. And that's, you know, that's totally your guys's, you know, that's like your opinion, man, as the dude would say. But in my perspective, as in terms of this film, this is kind of like those particular films where you just kind of are attached to it because of the fact that you recognize, or you see, if not yourself, you see parts of who you are in the film, or parts of, you know, of things that you recognize within your family, or the things that you connect with ultimately. And I think for me, the Hispanic culture that we live in today is inundated with this mindset of, much like myself, this perspective of, we need to be much like everybody else so that we don't stand out, or we need to act a certain way or talk a certain way so that way we can get the jobs that we want, or so that we're not misrepresented as like the help, or probably the the person who sells corn on the corner, whatever it may be. And I think that is a really big thing where, as Latinos in America, it's one of those things where we sometimes forget where we come from. And one of the things that I think with this particular film, even though it's not like it's not back in the 20s or 30s, you know, during the Cesar Chavez times, you know, with the revolts or the, you know, a lot of the things that would come about as part of our culture that would change the status quo and whatnot, this is the story of an individual whom many of the people that I know, people that I've actually been, or that are part of my family, have either held a role similar to this, or they've known somebody who's held a role similar to this, as in either somebody who's like a live-in nanny, or somebody who would go and clean houses, or somebody who would go and do certain things. And so I think for me, the unique aspect of this particular film for me is that I see me in this particular film, not as a young girl who grew up in the 70s or who was living in the 70s, gets pregnant and so forth. That's not what I'm saying at all. But I'm saying somebody who has been at a place where you feel like all you're doing is you're serving the other needs, and you know you have other things going on, and there are things that are going on around you, and in the midst of it all, there's tradition and culture and things that are around you that you totally have to look past because of the fact that you're doing a job, or you're here, or you're doing this. And I think for me, this kind of brought back to my memory, if you will, the stories and the instances that I've had and that I've been told by family who, honestly, some aren't even here anymore. But like hearing tales of like, you know, oh, well, my aunt who used to go and visit Mexico because her, you know, her cousin used to have a goat ranch, and she would go and try to catch goats with them, and they would have a good time and so forth. Like stories, little ridiculous stories like that. But she would talk about like the times and the instances. This film kind of brought back that type of storytelling to me, where I would sit for like 45 minutes to an hour just listening to my grandma rambling about why she doesn't let cats in the house anymore with babies. It's a really bad story.
Oh, I've heard that story. That's got a really sad ending.
It does. But like, I sat for like 45 minutes listening to my grandma tell this story in between laughs, and then she gets super serious at the end, and I'm like, wow, that escalated rather quickly. But those are the stories that I enjoy, and I think this is just kind of bringing that back for me in terms of watching this person's progress through this tale and through this journey. And even though, yes, Spence, it does end oddly in terms of how that progresses, that storyline goes, I think the coming together of recognizing family is what's important, and everybody who is in this story matters. I don't know, that just kind of brought it home to me. Personally.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's not the only story of its kind in that regard. In terms of, like, taking a character who is maybe less respected, or just is not given as much opportunity within the structure of society as other characters.
Yeah.
And championing the vital role that that person has in their community, their family, you know, whatever, in the structure of the story. I think that the challenge here is that this character is so effectively embedded into the scenery that it's difficult in a way to pull her out of the scenery and really give her the spotlight that you're trying to give. I mean, the film really asks you to focus.
Yeah.
Look exactly where I'm telling you slowly to look.
Mm-hmm.
Don't expect to whip your head around and see something else. Even if you hear it through the soundtrack, through the audio track of the scene, you are going to see exactly what I've decided you're going to see, which is always true of every movie.
Mm-hmm. Very true.
But here, there's so much visual lingering, and yet it's confounding because it's black and white. So, even then, great. Show me the scene. I want to drink in all of the visual richness of it. But it's black and white.
Yeah.
You know, so there's less information than what I'm used to having visually. Again, I'm not saying it's like categorically a bad thing.
No.
I think it is a film that will prove challenging for those of us who are like short attention span kind of people now.
yeah.
And not because it doesn't have a good story to tell or it's not technically extremely proficient, which it is.
Mm-hmm.
I got more of a tone poem kind of feel by the end of it, especially because it kind of ends open-endedly. And you can't read the credits at the end because of the light from the black and white, and the credits are in white. There's just sort of like a... You're supposed to just like ebb and flow and go with it and feel it and then like just let it linger in a way.
Yeah.
And I don't say that like negatively. I just say it doesn't have a lot of the components that you're used to seeing in most mainstream cinema.
True.
It very much would be an art house release.
Yeah.
I think if it weren't released on Netflix, it would be released to like independent theaters first, and then during awards season they'd maybe, you know, grant it a wide release so people could, you know, do what we all like to do at awards season and say, "Oh, what the heck is that about?"
Exactly.
All these films that are being nominated are films that 10% of the population at best have even heard of.
That's so true. So, wrapping up this conversation, Spencer, let's go ahead and start with you, and let's go ahead and give whether or not this film passes or fails and how many monocles.
Yeah, this film passes for me.
It passes.
Because, you know, it's...
You just made his day.
Really, it's a really well-done film.
I'll take that.
Okay.
I'll tell Guillermo.
I'm going to give it 3 out of 5, but this comes with, like, a little disclaimer. Like, if you think you can handle a slow pace of, like, just the entire movie, then you might think it's a 4.
Uh-huh.
But if you can't, then it's probably going to be a 2.
Uh-huh. All right.
What is this, NPR?
Delightful.
And next on NPR, we will be... Go ahead, Chad. Yeah, I'm also going to pass the film. It was challenging for me. I did pause the film and eat an entire meal about 2/3 of the way through because I was starting to fall asleep. We know that's not the first time that's happened to
me.
It's not. I think I'll also give it a 3. I'll give it a 3 because of its technical merit and the obvious affection that it has for its subject. But I found it a bit difficult to quote unquote enjoy watching the film, and part of that's because of what happens to the character.
Yeah.
And part of that is because of some of the things that we've talked about before.
Here I go. Well, the film obviously passes for me. I'm going to give this film a 4.5 out of 5. And this is the reason why. This film not only exceeded my expectations, because my expectations were kind of low. Because
you didn't have any.
I just didn't have any.
It exceeded my non-existent expectations. That's good.
There you go. But also for the fact that this film just really kept me engaged, even though it was a slow burn, even though it did take forever to build through the story, I had no problem sticking with it. I had no issue enjoying it. And for the fact that, you know what? This film was meant for me. You know, this film spoke to me. This film was created with the films that I like in mind, like with me in mind, so to speak. And I found a lot of, you know, just great imagery and great cinematography, and I loved the way this story transpired. I even loved the way how it historically represented the revolt that was going on during the 70s, you know, in Mexico City at the time. Like, all that happened, that was all true to form. That whole situation that happened towards the tail end of the movie, that was called the Corpus Christi Massacre. You know, all that stuff happened for real. And to see all that and like, man, I should know these things. I should be more, you know, in the know. But to say all that, the film is by far so far like a masterpiece. I really enjoyed it. And not to mention that the director that I adore gave it a glowing review and analysis on Twitter that I've been combing through. I'm like, yeah. So kudos to Guillermo. We both wrote that up together. You can ask him about it later. But yeah, the film passes for me, and I give it a 4.5 out of 5.
Pardon Spencer and I while we verbally roll our eyes.
But that about wraps up another awesome episode of The Filmlosophers. Remember, you can check out all of our previous episodes at thefilmlosophers.com, where you can check out all 145 episodes, because now this is 145. We want to let you know of a couple upcoming weekend releases, or release, if you will. Glass, the anticipated M. Night Shyamalan film, debuts this week, so check it out. And if you're not looking to see anything in the theaters, you can check out Roma on Netflix now, as well as other great films that are there. So you can head over to your queue and check out all the awesome stuff that's being released there. This was a great episode, and I had a great time talking about it. I don't know about you guys, but I did. And you know what? this was fun, and we can't wait to hear more from you later on the socials.
I like how your, like, Murica just came out.
Yeah, that was, you know,
I don't know if you guys did, but I did. America.
Because I'm American. But check out our socials as well at filmlosophers.com/filmlosophers or filmlosophy101 on Twitter. And we'd love to hear your thoughts. So, yeah. So, from all of us here at
Dunsky,
from all of us here at the Filmlosophers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Chad.
I'm Spence.
Class dismissed.